Thank you, Hilde. Thank you for the introduction. And thank you all for being here. To those of you who are wondering whether or not it's scary for a PhD student to stand here in this, on this large stage with this large audience, well, yes, it is. But it's also extremely exciting, and I'm thrilled to be here. I'd like to thank the committee who actually selected our research, and I think I speak on behalf of all of us to thank them as well. As you may notice, we don't have decades of experience to refer to, and we haven't spent our lifetime on research in autism spectrum disorders yet. But I think with our enthusiastic and young and lively vibe, I think we will represent the young researchers here. So all the PhD students who have their posters here or their talks here, we represent all of them. My name is Jolanda van der Meer. I'm a PhD student at the Radboud University Nijmegen, the Donners Institute for Brain Cognition and Behavior, which is also in collaboration with the Character, Child and Youth Psychiatry. And luckily, I don't do this research all by myself. I've got a great team with, amongst others, Professor Buitelaar, Professor Franke, Dr. Lambrecht-Schrommelsen, and Dr. Hartman, as well as some of the PhD students here who will present their work this afternoon as well. Today, I'd like to talk to you about my recently published findings, and the paper was entitled, "Are ASD and ADHD Different Manifestations of the Same Overarching Disorder?" This was based on a cognitive and symptom evidence from a clinical and population-based sample, and it got published in the journal of JCAP, actually, probably familiar. So we were really pleased with that. And I think this upcoming 20 minutes or so is time well spent for those who haven't read the article especially, since I'll drag you through it within 20 minutes. So in clinical practice, what do we see? A child, 5 years old or so, may be diagnosed with PDD, not otherwise specified, and while maturing, he or she may be 8 years old, and it may the diagnosis may change into ADHD. This is a disadvantage for clinical practice, for example, because it's not clear to the parents whether it's ADHD or ASD is confusing, and for clinical practice also because treatments will change. So should we focus on ADHD treatment or autism treatment? Up until now, with the DSM-4, you're not allowed to diagnose both ASD and ADHD within one child. And with the upcoming DSM-5, luckily we can. And this is not only an advantage for clinical practice, but also for research. And we really jumped into that in this current research. We combined ADHD and ASD measures. And another advantage of the DSM-5 is that autism is seen as a quantitative trait. So we won't, in the future, we won't see ASD as subtypes of Asperger and PDD-NOS, but we will see it as a whole continuum. And that is something we really focused on in our research as well, and which is also very much in line with the recent presentation, I guess it was last Thursday, by Professor Gilbert, who said, nature doesn't draw a line without smudging it. It's not that a child has ADHD or has nothing. And this is really something that's highlighted in this paper. We don't stick to any DSM-defined diagnosis or so. So please, for the upcoming 20 minutes, forget about the DSM and just go with this flow. Because we studied a gradient overarching disorder. I try to represent this in the figure presented. It's a simplification, obviously. You could see ADHD, according to this hypothesis, as a less severe subtype in the autism spectrum disorder continuum. If true, you can have ADHD without ASD symptoms, so you will be at the smaller piece of the triangle, and with increasing social communication difficulties, the type of ASD-specific difficulties, this may develop until ADHD plus ASD. So there's no such thing as ASD, according to this hypothesis, there's no such thing as ASD without ADHD symptoms. To study this, we used an empirical bottom-up approach. As such, we used a latent class analysis, which aims to make more homogeneous classes within this overarching disorder. With making such homogeneous classes, we hope to study their neurocognitive profiles. So if you have got homogeneous classes, which are more alike in their ADHD symptom levels and more alike in their amount of ASD symptoms, they are more alike, we suggest, in their neurocognitive profiles. So first, we make homogeneous classes on a behavioral level, and secondly, we check whether or not they are also more homogeneous on a cognitive level. So what was the population included? We included 644 children, partially from a clinical population, this was a genetic family-based study, and partially from a general population study, which was data collected from primary schools. All children were between 5 and 17 years of age, and didn't have an IQ below 70, so this was a reason to exclude children, and they didn't have any problems with vision or hearing or things which would potentially affect cognitive functioning. We collected symptom measures from all of these children. We asked parents to fill out, amongst others, a social communication questionnaire and the Connors Parent Rating Scale, and we used all subscale measures from these questionnaires and compared all children on these subscales. So it doesn't matter whether or not this amount of symptoms was above a clinical cutoff or below a clinical cutoff, we were totally ignoring this clinical cutoff. If you insert this in a latent class analysis, you can make more homogeneous groups. You can see whether 5 classes, 6 classes, 4 classes fits the data best. In our data, 5 classes fit the data best, and I'll now start showing you what the classes looked like. This figure may seem a bit daunting, but I'll drag you through it. On the y-axis, you can see the mean subscale sum scores, and I actually inserted a red line just to give an impression of the clinical relevance. We labeled these two classes, represented in a black and a gray line, normal, because they score on all subscales, which are represented on the x-axis, below a subscale level which can be seen as clinically relevant. Obviously, there are no clinical cutoffs for subscales, but this is just to give you an impression. On the left side, you can see ASD subscales. In the middle, there are ADHD subscales. And on the right side are the comorbid problems subscales. The third class we found, we labeled this ADHD. Once again, it doesn't state that it's clinically relevant or officially diagnosed the ADHD, but it's just to give you an impression of the behavior presented. These children had elevated scores on inattention, restlessness, cognitive problems, and hyperactivity. As you can see, they don't have elevated scores on ASD. So this is actually well in line with the gradient overarching disorder, that you can have ADHD without ASD. The fourth class we found, so these are all children in this class, in this bluish, purplish color. These children have highly elevated scores on ADHD and also ASD scores, which are above the clinical cutoff. We decided to label this class ADHD plus ASD. This because ADHD was more severe than ASD. The final class we found was ASD plus ADHD. As you can see, the ASD symptoms were more severe than the ADHD symptoms. And the ADHD symptoms were at the same level as the ADHD symptoms in the ADHD-only class. And here you can see some scores on the comorbid problems. As you can see, the class with ASD more severe than ADHD has elevated scores on perfectionism, etc. You can take a look. In line with the gradient overarching disorder is that we did not find a class with only ASD symptoms. Doesn't mean that there are no people in the world with only ASD without ADHD, but based on our sample, there was not a clinically relevant class with only ASD symptoms and no ADHD symptoms. For further analyses, we decided to group the two normally scoring classes together, because these children were not clinically relevant in their distinction on all of these subscales. To give you an impression of the sizes of all of these classes, luckily most kids scored normal, about 60% were in class 1 and 2, 20% scored in the ADHD-only class, was merged in that class, and 10% in classes 4 and 5. So now that we've made an empirical bottom-up approach, so we've made 5 classes which are more alike in their behavior, we started to take a look at the neurocognitive profiles, so how the kids scored in cognitive task battery. Therefore, we used the ANT, the Amsterdamse Neuropsychological Task Battery, developed by Dr. de Zonneville, who should be here somewhere. And we used several tasks from this battery, amongst others. Or actually, for this paper, we studied baseline speed and variability, executive functioning, attention to detail, and emotion recognition. And for baseline speed and motor variability, we measured response time and variability in response time. For executive functioning, there were attention and working memory, both verbal and visual. Attention to details was measured with block patterns. And emotion recognition was both accuracy and speed in the recognition of facial emotions. I'll show you all of these results on these different cognitive domains, and I'll sum them up afterwards as well. So what have we got here? On the y-axis, you can see the z-score, so all these scores are normalized. And a score, this is ongoing for all presented results, bars which go upwards are better performances, and downwards bars are worse performances. And on the left side here are the normally scoring kids, here are the ADHD-only kids, and here are the ADHD plus ASD, and here are the ASD plus ADHD kids. And as expected, I guess, baseline speed and motor variability reduced as soon as cognitive behavioral problems increased. So an increase of baseline motor speed was reduced, so they were slower and more variable when they presented more behavioral problems. This ADHD-only class was scoring somewhat intermediate, and this is a pattern we'll see in some other cognitive domains as well. This is attention, like I said, verbal and visual. Verbal is presented in red and visual in green. There are a large amount of significant differences. And I must say all significant findings are after FDA correction, so after correction for multiple comparisons. Both visual and verbal attention drop as soon as there's an increased amount of behavioral problems. Then, going on to working memory, here's something interesting. We don't see an increase, or not a significant increase, in reduced performances on visual and verbal working memory for the ASD plus ADHD class, but we do find this for the ADHD plus ASD class. So this may suggest that if ADHD is more profound or if ADHD is only present, working memory is affected. Whereas if ASD is more profound, the working memory is not so much affected. Perhaps working memory is ADHD specific or so. Then attention to details. Here it's very remarkable. You remember previously there was a reduced performance with an increased behavioral problems. But here you can see that if the ADHD is more profound than the ASD, the performance is severely reduced. But if ASD is more profound than ADHD, children perform quite well actually at the performance level of the normally developing children. So here there's this distinction on a cognitive level, which is hard to make on a behavioral level, because both children present ASD and ADHD symptoms. Then emotion recognition, so the identification of facial emotions. This is speed, and this is accuracy in green. And as expected, with an increase of ASD symptoms, performances in emotion recognition is reduced. As promised, in sum, the results. Baseline speed and variability was only affected in the children with most behavioral deficits, behavioral problems. Attention doesn't distinguish quite well, doesn't distinguish well between the affected classes. Working memory is affected, especially if ADHD is present or most profound. Attention to details is affected if ADHD is more profound than ASD, but not, and even is quite good if ASD is more profound than ADHD. And emotion recognition is affected as soon as ASD comes into play. So what do these findings tell us? What I'd like you to take home is that we didn't find ASD without ADHD symptoms. Perhaps you can find this within a complete population-based sample, because there may be a referral bias, which Professor Gilberg also referred to, that children with ASD are only referred to clinical settings as soon as there are comorbidities, but not if there's only ASD. But still, our sample had children with ASD and also their unaffected or relatively unaffected siblings. Our normal class and our class with ADHD only was somewhat younger than the both comorbid classes. We corrected for these age differences, and this also can't explain the differences between both comorbid classes on the cognitive level. And there were sex differences, obviously, as expected. As soon as the amount of ASD and ADHD symptom increased, there were more boys in those classes. For our future research, we take a closer look at the children which behave quite well, so they're both normal classes. And we we compare them not on the SQ and the Cornish-Parent rating scale, but on two subscales which actually include the autism quotient and the SWAN, which actually includes strengths as well as weaknesses. I'd like to thank you for your attention. And here are here's actually the paper presented and some contact information if you'd like to get in touch, which I would greatly appreciate. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Questions? Am I going to look?
Thank you. That's better. All your groups were matched for IQ and normal above 70. Is that right?
I've got the...
My question, it's a general question actually, is what are we to do with the so-called low-functioning autistic people?
Yeah.
You know, how are we to understand that particular group? Is it a group or is it something entirely different?
Well, those are exactly the children which I didn't include, right? So you're interested in the ASD-affected children below 70. I think it's, and I guess you agree on that, it's hard to diagnose ASD as soon as there's a learning deficit or IQ problems or IQ below 70. And what was your question again? What should you do with
the question really is, we've heard a lot about the comorbidities and the overlap and so on. Mostly, I'm assuming that we're talking about so-called high-functioning people with autism or Asperger's, if indeed there is a difference. But what's left, what hasn't really been spoken about very much, is the low-functioning people with autism. And I'm a little confused as to how I'm supposed to think about that as a group.
Okay. I'm sorry to say that I didn't look at those people. Yeah.
Other questions? I actually do have a question. I was wondering, because you started with the hypothesis that it might be a less severe form of ASD, so ADHD is a less severe form of ASD, but not all your results were pointing in that direction when you look at the cognitive profile. So I was wondering, what is your hypothesis right now?
It's correct that the hypothesis isn't completely approved. Yeah, there's some cognitive distinction between ASD and ADHD. So the fact that there's an increase in cognitive deficits as soon as there's increase of behavioral deficits, behavioral symptoms, is in line with the disorder, but the cognitive distinction, so that the fact that they don't only differ quantitatively but also on a qualitative basis, is not in line with the overarching disorder hypothesis. Yeah.
Any other questions? No? Okay, thanks again. Come.